The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war.
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. My guest is retired Air Force Colonel Walker Bud Mahurin, one of America's most distinguished fighter pilots. He was the first double ace in Europe during World War II, recipient of the Silver Star, and the only U.S. pilot to record victories over enemy aircraft in both the European and Pacific theaters in World War II and in the Korean War. His lifelong love affair with aviation began at a very early age.
Well, I go back from that era when, for kids my age then, this before high school, being a railroad engineer was important, and so was being a pilot because of Lindbergh. So those were sort of two things that kids thought of. And I used to walk down to the railroad station in Fort Wayne and watch the trains come in from Chicago and from the West Coast, East Coast, and on, say, gee, I'd love to be a railroad engineer. But then all of a sudden I found out Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic Ocean. That made a lot of difference. And then, of course, since then in my life, I've met Charlie Lindbergh and met a lot of people who were involved in that aspect of our life. So that desire shifted gears, and I ended up by flying initially in the civilian pilot training, flying part of our government flight education.
Where were you on December 7th of 42?
Primary Flying School and at Chickasha, Oklahoma. And I've been back there a couple of times since, and I don't want to go there again. Although you may recall that the Will Rogers Field is in from Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
It's outside of Tulsa, I believe.
Well, were you there in anticipation of going into the service, or were you there just originally to get a private license?
Well, part of the program, since it was called the Civilian Pilot Training Program, and it was run by our government, if the objective was to get us as much of a license as we could. And I got a private pilot's license just by staying with the program. And they had both a primary school and an advanced school. And a lot of guys went on to take advanced in the same program. And I missed that, although I knew a lot of those guys that were trained by civilian pilot training and knew them as flyers.
Mm-hmm. And when did you go in the service?
Well, it sort of was a function of not exactly joining, but I was eligible for the draft. And so I was kind of on one side racing for the draft and on the other side racing to get involved in civilian pilot training. And civilian pilot training won, and the draft didn't. And so when I was drafted for CPT, my first class was in Chickasha, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they were doing a lot of civilian pilot training. Please excuse me for my voice. It varies a lot, and I don't know why.
No problem. So when did you actually go in the Army Air Corps?
Yeah, I graduated from flying school in April of 1942. I was actually in primary flying school when the Japs struck Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And another interesting episode in that we were all called by our commanders and had to appear all scared to death. The Jap fleet was coming up the Gulf, and I had no idea then, which I do now, of the lack of danger really to us in America, but we were all very excited at that time.
Well, where did they ship you off for your military training?
When I got my civilian pilot training graduation, I was automatically called into our Air Force, and I became a cadet, aviation cadet, and went from there to become a second lieutenant. But of course, having the flying under my belt was a big convenience because I knew what it was like then. Mm-hmm. Even though I always wanted to fly, this time I'm doing it.
Where did you train?
Fort Wayne, Indiana. That's where I first flew, and in civilian pilot training.
Right. Where was your military training?
It started in Chickasaw, Oklahoma.
Right.
And by the way, that school was a official military ground school, and it was founded by some people from Denver. And there were two people. They call it the Wilson Bonfils Flying School. Mm-hmm. And they were handling a whole bunch of classes at that time. We were the first class. And then I went from there to Randolph, which of course was called the West Point of the Air. Mm-hmm. And from that school, I went to Ellington, Texas, which was the Advanced Flying School.
Right. What were you flying?
They were, at that time, we were flying in graduate work, the AT-6, the Texan, as graduate students. And when I got out of that, I was transferred to a fighter group that was out of Teaneck, New Jersey, and it was doing its flying training in Fort Dix. Mm-hmm. And then we were destined to go overseas, but I didn't know it at that time. And we did a little bit of flying at Fort Dix, and then we got on the Queen Elizabeth, not this one, the old one, and went to England.
When did you get into the P-47 Razorback?
We were the first squadron to get them from the factory, and Gabreski probably told you that. It was called the 56th Fighter Group, mm-hmm. and we were in the 63rd Squadron, and we were stationed at Mitchell Field in Long Island, and we got P-47 mostly because we were close to the factory. So if there were any delinquencies as far as the equipment was concerned, we were close enough to kind of get them handled by Republic and by the military service.
How did that plane handle?
Well, I always get asked that because I've flown a lot since then.
Right.
And people always want to know, did I like the P-47 more than I liked the Mustang, the 51? And of course, I liked the Mustang better than the P-47. Big problem of range, fuel consumption, and that sort of thing. And that 2,000 horsepower engine was pretty critical on fuel.
Well, it also gave you much more climbing capability, didn't it?
No, it was not a good climber.
No?
No.
The Mustang?
Oh, the Mustang, yeah. Not only climbing, but had range.
Right.
It was a fine airplane. Still is. As a matter of fact, I just got a letter from, I think they call it, it's something like the Mustang Flyboys. But everybody that owns a Mustang now gathers, and they become an annual affair where they fly the Mustangs in and entertain each other and mm-hmm. have an air show. And that's very popular. Of course, it's popular with the guys that own Mustangs, too.
Yeah. So when did you actually go into combat for the first time?
You know, I don't remember when it was the first time, but...
Well, how did you find out you were going? You were in England at the time?
No. We knew that when we were graduating from flying school, that we were going to go to England. They lined, at flying school, they lined all the graduation of my class up on the ramp at Ellington Field down in Houston. And they said, okay, everybody 5'9" and below will be going to fighters, and everybody 5'10" would be going to bombers. And so I was selected to go to fighters.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I wanted to do that anyway. And off we went on that basis. And I think we were the first active P-47 group to hit England.
Mm-hmm.
And Gabreski was in that group. A lot of guys that ultimately became notorious. Bob Johnson, who ended up by being the first ace to exceed Rickenbacker, he was a member of that group also.
Mm-hmm. And were all of your combat missions flown out of England?
No. I flew for 17 months out of England, and then I was shot down on a dive bombing mission, escorting bombers in France, and I bailed out of my airplane and became a member of the French underground for about 27 days. And I got out of France and came back in. And in those days, they wouldn't let us fly out again because, in theory, they said that if you're shot down again, the Luftwaffe could treat you as a spy. So we won't do that. And so I had to come back home. And when I did that, I became a member of what was then called the 3rd Air Commando Group. And I flew with them till the war ended in Japan. We had 51s then.
Mm-hmm. But at the time you were in France, you were flown out in some kind of antique airplane by the underground?
No, it wasn't antique. They were doing a lot of resupplying by, oh, good gracious. That's another trouble with being old.
But the underground had some planes of its own then?
No.
No?
The RAF flew us in, or flew us out.
Oh, really?
And they were getting resupplied by RAF airplanes. The spies were in France. And I, of course, didn't know it at the time, but I had the luck to become involved with an underground outfit that had spies. And they had been in contact with the Royal Air Force through the BBC. And through that contact, they could schedule flights in and out of the Low Countries and drop supplies and ammunition and spies into the Low Countries. And I was pretty lucky.
We're visiting this week with Air Force Colonel Bud Mahurin about his experiences in World War II and Korea. We'll continue our conversation after these messages.
A special thanks to you veterans for your service to our country.
The latest official report from Washington said that warships had broken off the action and retreated.
From the Radio America Network. Veterans Chronicles is now available wherever you are.
Through your MP3 player.
Log on to www.radioamerica.org
and click on the podcasting icon.
Look for Veterans Chronicles. Then follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast.
You can also find the Veterans Chronicles podcast on Apple iTunes.
The Veterans Chronicles podcast.
Now online
at radioamerica.org.
Listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. Bud Mahurin had shot down 20 German aircraft when his luck ran out over Europe and his P-47 was hit and set on fire. Fortunately, he was picked up by members of the French underground and not the Nazis.
I think at that time, I kind of think, I'll say 20 because I can't remember it clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But Bob Johnson and I were in sort of an ace race. A lot of guys in the 8th Air Force had shot a number of fighter airplanes down of the Luftwaffe. And so we were all competing with each other, although you couldn't call it a competition.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were also obviously competing with the Germans. What were they like as pilots?
Well, they're damn good. As a matter of fact, I ended up becoming an honorary member of the German Fighter Pilots Association, and I knew after the war was over, I got to know quite a few of them. And I'm not very proud of this, but it happened. I shot down Adolf Galland's brother.
Oh, really?
And of course, I didn't know it as his brother at the time, but I have met Adolf a number of times and seen him both in Germany and in this country.
Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't let you go back to Europe for obvious reasons, and you pulled a few strings and got sent to the Pacific, right?
Well, you have a now he's almost a native of Washington, D.C. His name is Brigadier General John Allison. And Johnny Allison was also a member of this commando organization, and he got to know a lot of those guys too. And I knew he was back home here looking for pilots, so I called him and told him that I wanted to join up with him. And had to write a letter to Hap Arnold and ask for permission, and I got assigned to the commando organization, and I was back in the Pacific in a year.
But the war was pretty much winding down by then.
No, it was going still pretty good.
I didn't think there were many Japanese aircraft left, though.
Well, I started out in my first overseas combat tour was in New Guinea, and the commandos, the people that I was with, were flying out of New Guinea to start with, and we worked our way all the way up through the islands to Hokkaido, the last island in the Japanese chain that we conquered.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I had that kind of combat experience. Not, it differed a lot from the Luftwaffe, but still I had that combat experience against the Japanese.
Well, then you went on to have the combat experience you had in Korea.
Yeah, but the Korean thing lasted a little longer because I got shot down again. And I spent 14 months as a prisoner of war in North Korea.
Right. Well, before we get to that, tell me a little bit about the transition from the Mustang to the F-86.
Well, I think everybody that flew and flies the Mustang thinks it's a great airplane. Of course, it's piston engine, so you're encumbered with that thing. But the F-86 is one of the finest fighters that our industry has ever designed, I think. And it's still quite active around the world. There are not very many of them flying anymore. I am associated with an air museum in Chino, California. They have one that flies. But they're expensive now for a private pilot. And so most of those airplanes are owned and operated by museum activity.
Mm-hmm.
And
but this was the first war where jet went against jet.
Yeah, except, of course, the Navy was flying them, too.
Right.
Not that airplane, but flying jets.
Right. But you're up against the MiGs.
Yes.
And how did the Sabre jet compare to the MiG?
Well, it depended upon who you would talk to. Because if you were an F-86 pilot, he'd usually say, oh, gee, that MiG was a wonderful airplane, and if we'd only had 200 or 300 of them, there wouldn't have been a war. That kind of baloney. That was not true. The MiG was a very good airplane for its time. It wasn't as fast as the Sabre was. It could climb higher than the Sabre could. And the Sabre, I believe, could dive faster than the MiG could.
Mm-hmm.
And we, like pilots do, you believe you're as good as any of them, so you were not fearful of the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never really desired flying a MiG, although I'd love to fly it now. And even today, I think the MiG was a very successful airplane for its time. And it was a big shock to us in our military because it had such high performance.
But I understand from some of the reading I've done that the performance of the pilots was not that great.
Well, it wasn't that so much. This is a long discussion because in that society, the military has control, iron control. And as a result, a pilot couldn't go off and do what he wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the ground people were in charge, and they would tell the pilots where to go, what to do, and so forth. So they were restricted. And we ended up where we knew that, and we could listen to their air-to-ground communication and take advantage of that communication so we could sort of determine where the enemy was going and what location they would be at after a period of time.
When we return, Bud Mahurin recounts his time in Korea, his aerial battles against MiG fighters, his capture and torture by North Korean and Chinese interrogators.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veteran Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out, get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest pace.
We'll have the ammunition and we'll all.
We cheer for Harlem on parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, talking this week with Air Force Colonel Bud Mahurin, a double ace in World War II, recipient of the Silver Star. 6 years after that conflict, he was in Korea, commanding the 4th Fighter Interceptor Wing and flying the F-86 Sabre jet. Here, the rules of engagement were different. For example, Mahurin and his comrades were not allowed to pursue enemy rigs across the Yalu River. Supposedly.
Well, we were not allowed to, but we did it anyway. and as a result, we had to be very careful for fear the folks at home would find out we were doing that. And, of course, we'd chase them over. We finally got instructions where they were calling it, if you're in a combat chase and they cross the Yalu River, you can go after them. But to just jump in an airplane and go up to Moncton in Manchuria was not the thing to do, because you'd hear about that.
Well, you also had the capability to try to lure them south of the river, didn't you?
Well, that was in every case, air war, the combat, the tactics change. And in our case, they changed a lot because the MiG pilots didn't want to come over on our side ultimately, and we were not supposed to go on their side, but we went over there if we could find them, and usually we were quite successful, and there were lots of interesting dogfights, and I keep telling everybody, if I was called upon to do it again, I'd go, because that was more fun than anything I've ever done in my life. It was a thrill.
It couldn't have been much fun when they finally smoked you.
No, but I signed up. As they say, you shouldn't have signed up. And I was over there because I wanted to be. And when they got me because I had been started dive bombing with the F-86s. And the mission that I was a group commander then. The mission that I was on, we carried two 1,000-pound bombs each for our F-86s. We went to a target that we were almost certain we could go back, drop our bombs, and get back home safely. And on that last mission, I got hit by ground fire, and I flew my 86 into the ground. And so that put an end to that. And, of course, this is another whole long story, but the Chinese had alleged that we were dropping germ warfare against them. And so part of my interrogation when I was captured was they wanted me to confess to the fact that I started the germ warfare campaign against them. And I fought that pretty hard to the point, to the day that I got out of North Korea. In fact, at one point while I was a prisoner of war, I slashed my wrists because I decided that the interrogation techniques would get what they wanted, and I knew if they got it, it would be harmful to our side, to the free world. And so I decided I was going to try to commit suicide, but they caught me. Mm-hmm. And it started interrogation all over again.
Well, this was the war that gave us the word brainwashing. Obviously, used every means at their disposal to try to get you to talk or confess, right?
Yeah, well, these techniques were, as you recall, were started by a Russian whose name was Pavlov. It was called reflex conditioning. And the idea is to deprive an individual of sleep and food and rest of any kind to the point where he's willing to say anything that they want him to say. And at that time, you're so weak that you want to give in anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy that I blame mostly for starting that was an Australian whose name was Wilfred Burchett. And Burchett was he alleged that he was a newspaper correspondent, but he wasn't. He was in the Secret Service for the.
I have met Burchett, as a matter of fact.
Oh, have you really?
In Korea. He was supposedly, as you say, an Australian journalist, but I first ran into him at Panmunjom when I was a Navy officer.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, you probably met, he had a compatriot over there. God, I've forgotten his name. He died, that's why I've forgotten him. I can't remember, but I will remember. He was also allegedly a newspaper correspondent.
Right, that was a common cover, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
So how did you learn finally that you were going to be released?
Well, eventually they called the war to a halt.
Right.
So they released all the prisoners of war, including me and the guys that they held up north. And we all came down in about 3 days into our side to Panmunjom at Freedom Village.
Right.
And then I knew I was going to come home. But until that time, I was told by our side they didn't know I was alive until I got home.
Mm-hmm.
I know they didn't from my hometown.
Mm-hmm. Now, after the war, you spent a good deal of your career trying to help other people understand these interrogation methods, did you not?
Well, I tried. I felt that if we were going to have another war, then maybe I ought to share my experiences so younger men who would come along could know a little bit about what they would have to encounter. And so I wrote a book called Honest John, which was my radio call sign. And it was used as a instructor's book at their war college. Mm-hmm. For quite some time. Because they didn't print very many of them, it's become quite hard to find them. But I think I sold about 8,000 or 9,000 copies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I know a lot of people who have read it, and a lot of people who I think gained having read it. And so I'm glad I did it. And then, of course, I had the problem as an individual of knowing that confession would have an impact on my career. And so I've been a colonel, I think, I've even forgotten that now, for at least a couple of years. And I was reasonably certain that my chances of being promoted to brigadier general were practically zero, because Congress in those days were taking pot shots at anybody they could shoot with a career that they were suspect of.
But particularly, as I recall, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Russell.
Russell. He was one of the vociferous ones.
Right.
And we had our Secretary of the Air Force was named Wilson then, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And Russell had queried the Secretary of the Air Force about that, and the response the Air Force gave was, we're not going to do anything that's hasty. We'll check into it all, and then we'll decide what to do. So from my standpoint as a regular Air Force officer on active duty. Those words sounded good, but all I had to do was pick up our papers and find out that we were castigating this person and that person, and you couldn't depend on it.
So then you resigned your commission and went into civilian aviation work.
Yes. I worked first for the Northrop Corporation. After that, I worked for Rockwell. Then I worked for McDonnell Douglas. I had graduated from Purdue University, and I had an aeronautical engineering degree. And I got involved in the Pentagon building with the design of some of our latest fighters. Mm-hmm. And that was fun, and I had a lot of fun doing it. And it was interesting. I got out to see the industry, got some knowledge of how the industry lived. And so in that respect, I was glad I did that, except that I still would like to have stayed on as a military officer.
Mm-hmm. The flying itself, how long did you continue that?
Well, I think I said I have a little Piper Cherokee myself. I quit that about a year ago. I was going down to Luke Air Force Base, which is our biggest fighter training base now. And every year they'd invite me to come down and talk to them. And I started down. My wife said she didn't want to go. And on the way down, I lost a cylinder. It only had four of them. And I had to make a landing at Indio, California. And it took me about 4 months, and I think about 14,000 to put the airplane back on its feet again. But I haven't flown very much since then.
Mm-hmm.
And she won't let me, and she won't go with me anymore.
But after you left the active duty, did you continue flying planes that were being produced by Grumman or McDonnell Douglas? Or?
Yeah, I flew quite a few of the Rockwell airplanes, and not as a test pilot per se. I wasn't doing the Charlie Yeager kind of test work, but I was flying, in essence, production test, that sort of thing. Whenever they had an airplane to fly, they could call on me and I'd go because I was current in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the F-86D was Rockwell's first air defense interceptor, radar interceptor, and I was current in that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to know a lot of their staff, a lot of their equipment, and a lot of their factory capability. And that was fun.
Well, you look back on a long span of remarkable events, and you played a big role in them. If you correct me, I believe you're the only Air Force pilot who had enemy kills in the European theater of World War II, the Pacific theater, and in Korea.
That's right. And I'm also, I think, about the only guy that got shot down as many times as I did. And I can look back on that, though, now. And when I talk to the guys at Luke, the pilots, I tell them, I'm going to tell you what you shouldn't do if you're a military officer and what you should do. And for God's sake, don't do something that you think is stupid, because every time I've been shot down, it was because I was doing something stupid. And remember, God isn't going to help you fly that airplane. You got your hands on the stick, and it's got to be you that gets yourself out in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they all nod their heads, so I think they're beginning to understand that. But gee, you look at our press now, and we're building a fighter airplane that's, the stories I get, it's going to be like $50 billion a piece. And I say to these kids, my God, that's an awful responsibility. Can you imagine crawling up the side of an airplane that's worth $50 billion and know you're in charge? And they're all sort of shaking their heads because it really is an awful responsibility. Of course, I think you're doing it the wrong way. We're building a $50 billion fighter airplane, but who's got a fighter that'll go against it in this world today? Nobody has. Yet the airplanes that we're getting lost are the Chinooks that are flying troops back and forth in Iraq, small performance airplanes. It looks to me like we ought to gear our military around to where we were building things like a paraglider with a little light-powered engine that our infantry guys can fly. They could equip it with a couple of rocket-propelled grenades and escort those Chinooks and take them back and forth to where they're going. So if somebody tried to get them on the ground, they wouldn't have a chance. And we wouldn't be wasting this high-powered, mega-expensive airplanes to defense the Chinooks. And I think we should have hundreds, if not thousands, of those things that were trained by the average guy. And it wouldn't be hard to do, and it wouldn't be expensive. Mm-hmm. But try and get the guy that's in the office that's in charge of building that $50 billion to say that, and he's not going to do that. He wants that responsibility.
I think you're right about that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
If we could do something like that, I've been telling everybody I talk to, I'd take the first wing of those Regala wings over there myself. In fact, I'd go myself to Iraq if they send me, but I'm too old now. And I know it, and they know it, and they sneer every time I even suggest it. But to me, as a nation, we're killing off our youth. Those are the guys that'll be coming after me. And we shouldn't kill them off. We should either figure out ways to keep them alive and put them in a defense mechanism and fix it so they can't get hurt, because they're the pride of our country.
Thanks to Colonel Bud Mahurin for sharing his memories of World War II in Korea. When we come back, our weekly World War II Chronicle and a salute to an American military hero. This is Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiadin area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.